This is Philosophy Weekly. I'm Doc Searles. This week's Simon Phipps and I talk with Seth Frye of University of California at Davis. He's a professor there, sociologist, studier of all things, all interesting things, I think, about community and open source, democracy, how it all works, governance, how it's never quite done. And there's so much to study. Really interesting stuff. Great dialogue between him and Simon, especially because Simon's involved in that kind of thing. It's a really good show, and that is coming up next.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Floss Weekly, episode 723, recorded Wednesday, March 15th, 2023. Freedom to Fork. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Collide. That's Collide with a K. Collide is a device trust solution that ensures that if a device isn't secure, it can't access your apps. It's zero trust for Okta. Visit collide.com/floss and book a demo today. Hello again, everybody everywhere. I am Doc Searles, and I am joined this week by Simon Phipps himself in yet another place in his house or lair or abode or location in Southampton in the
up
UK.
Above ground again, up in the upstairs office.
Don't let the altitude get to you. You're only 4 hours ahead of me now. So I've been.
Yeah, it's like the middle of the afternoon, all because you're having your daylight savings over there. I hope you can save daylight. I trust that you're going to be able to do it.
Yeah, well, we have some here. I'm in the middle of Indiana. Indiana is far west as you could get and still be in the Eastern time zone. So when I talk to people in Boston or New York, it's dark there while it's still light here. It's weird. But anyway, there it is. So our guest today is Seth Frye of UC Davis and much else. Have you read or checked out any of his stuff?
Absolutely nothing. Nothing.
Get a crash course. Oh, man.
Yeah. So I had a look at
You doing your homework.
I got your email yesterday saying I was on the show, which was a surprise. And I clicked through some of the links and I've had a little look about what Seth is doing. And I'm still completely unfamiliar with what he's doing. I honestly never run into anything he's done before. So this is a great big learning experience.
Now's your chance to crash hard into it. So with that, I'm just going to go ahead and give the brief incomplete bio on Seth. He's a cognitive scientist, computational social scientist who studies human decision behavior in complex social environments, which you are expert in Simon, with your open source background. His expertise is in computational approaches to self-governance and the cognitive science of strategic behavior. He's a professor in communication at UC Davis in California, in the Computational Communication Lab, an affiliate in the Ostrom Workshop at Indiana University, which is where I intersect with him, also at D-Web Camp, where we got to hang out a bit. He's got a site in Fascination on the transmission of wonder. There's got a blog that connects the mundane daily practice of science with experiences of wonder and humility that make it all worth doing. So welcome, Seth. There you are. Where are you, by the way? I believe you're at an Airbnb, I heard, or something like that.
No, I'm on the university campus.
I suspected that because you seem to be surrounded by whiteboards and
that's right, dirty ones, well used.
Yeah, I know. They've got that look, like, you know, it never comes off, but it kind of smudges around and I think cave walls were like that. So tell us a bit about, you know, what you've been doing, and I'm especially interested in the governance side of it. Just tell us, give us the whole framework, because you cover a lot of ground.
Okay,
and that's why I wanted you on the show.
Yeah, so I've cared about self-governance for a long time personally, because I live with a bunch of people. I lived in community for a long time. Cooperative houses as small as 4 people, as big as 400 people. And there's amazing variety and diversity in how they all succeed or fail at keeping the kitchen sink clean. And this is the fundamental problem of, it's a microcosm of the biggest problems facing humanity. That is climate change and deforestation and overfishing and superbugs even. They all have the same logical structure. They're all examples of common pool resources. And
go ahead. Yeah, sorry.
And so you can imagine my delight to find out that there's, in the middle of doing this and struggling with it during grad school, I discovered that there's a science of it. There's a woman named Eleanor Ostrom, and she had developed really impressive methodologies and performed very impressive studies of common pool resource systems. And the key to it was she was able to get lots and lots and lots of them into one book, Governing the Commons, and then lots and lots and lots of them into two other books. I'm trained as a cognitive scientist, so I get thousands of people in the room if I want to understand humans. So if I want to understand commons, I shouldn't really do a case study, which is what you normally do, because it's hard to go to hundreds or thousands of communities. But she managed it and would compare hundreds and hundreds to extract general design principles of sustainable common pool resource management, sustainable self-governance, effective empowering leadership or structure or voting. I've over the years taken my career more and more in that direction, moving to online communities, comparing hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands of online communities that self-govern in order to extend these insights into common pool resource management, and also serve the mission of a lot of these online communities, such as open source software projects.
So I want to go back briefly to you're living in a house with people, because I think the biggest divider of people is between those who leave dishes piled up in the sink and those who clean them up. I am a messy person, but I'm one of the ones who cleans them up. My wife is a very neat person, and who I think at least some of the time believes that putting dishes in the sink cleans them. And I have a son as well, but I'm wondering about that. I mean, to what extent do those kind of things reveal something about people, like an out of sight, out of mind sort of thing?
Oh, I don't need it to mean anything. We're really different. Society is the process of us, despite being really different, managing to kind of get along together, and whatever solution you can urge to in your household. There's room for what we might call institutional diversity. I'm not too normative about things.
Yeah. So have you looked at open source communities or any in particular, or can we speak of them in a more general sense? Because that's where Simon comes in. He's been involved in lots of them. I've just observed them as a reporter.
Right. Well, so I do have this comparative angle. We'll actually be at PyCon next month, talking to communities that are transitioning from benevolent dictatorship to community management. But I'd say my deepest studies have been of the Apache Software Foundation Incubator, which is a nice little clatch of 300 projects that are transitioning their governance style from whatever they started up with, whatever got them off the ground, to the Apache Software Foundation's kind of more standard formal umbrella. And I have a project on GitHub projects as well.
So Simon, we're chatting in the back channel.
We're both reading a different screen there. So I have questions, Seth. I'm quite fascinated. So I admitted at the beginning that I've been speed reading your websites over the last few hours. So one of the things that concerns me about the study of governance mechanisms is its constant reference to the tragedy of the commons. Because I've seen quite a lot of work that has suggested that Garrett Hardings original work is actually deeply flawed, that basically he is a person who is rediscovering his initial suppositions rather than uncovering a truth, and that actually other elements of the conduct of human nature mean that a tragedy of the commons is not inevitable in a self-governed community. Do you want to comment on the validity of tragedy of the commons before we go anywhere near open source?
Sure. You can start a social system in one way and it can end up in lots of ways. And there's no doubt that the tragedy of the commons is one way that you can end up. I wouldn't agree that the concept of the tragedy of the commons is flawed. Certainly Garrett Hardin was flawed. But the tragedy of the commons is an outcome. Is it inevitable? Certainly not. And he argued that different institutional regimes, that, you know, there's also centralized enforcement and privatization, which was sort of what he ended up advocating, which aligns very well with the whole 20th century narrative of, you know, freedom versus communism or whatever. And so he fits into like a broader 20th century narrative and sets up the scene nicely for figures like Eleanor Ostrom, who won the Nobel Prize in economics precisely for breaking that state versus market dichotomy or state versus tragedy dichotomy by demonstrating that, yes, just like you say, people can talk, come up with solutions, negotiate solutions to the tragedy of the commons that align with their own values, that exhibit community values, that exhibit norms, care, mutual regard, and also, you know, some extent leadership centralization, that in between those extremes of, you know, failure or the state, you have a whole bunch of stuff. And everything she developed was to expose, to give us language for talking about everything in the middle, including democratic solutions.
Right. Now, when it comes to open source, I've been involved in both establishing and coaxing along a number of open source communities. And I have to tell you that I'm getting much less persuaded by the value of a purely democratic approach to community governance. Do you want to talk a little bit about what you found in the long term from communities in open source, I don't know whether you've looked at that or whether you've only been looking at the transition from adhocracies to more formal governance? What is the best way of preparing for the long-term future where nobody that's involved today is involved tomorrow?
Before I get to longevity, I can actually maybe speak a little bit to this, you know, questioning the value of democracy. Two audiences that are more accustomed to this kind of market versus state dialogue. I'm a big old advocate for democracy, big enthusiast, and big practitioner, living it every day in little mundane ways. Two democracy advocates, I tend to be one of the loudest voices in favor of leadership, hierarchy, bureaucracy. I think there's a lot to be said for institutional diversity, even if it looks like a backstep sometimes. And you really see it in open source. Democracy's overkill for an early project just starting. So in the communities I'm involved in, we tend to be really big advocates for what you might call temporary benevolent dictatorship, which is have one person drive their passion project until it's worth it to other people to put in the extraordinary amount of work of self-governance. So democracy is a pain, and Americans especially, people who live in market societies based around private property, are sharing muscles of atrophied. Our democracy engagement, mutual regard muscles in many ways are atrophied. It takes a lot of practice to be effective in democracy and for democracy to be worth the work. And I think it takes quite high stakes. I think You need to be managing something that's really, really meaningful to you for democracy to be worth the work. That's not to say there isn't a lot of room for participation, but I'm often impressed by how benevolent dictatorships or other structures can effectively integrate the needs and values of multiple stakeholders, which for me is a little more fundamental than democracy. Democracy is one way of executing, integrating the needs of lots of kinds of people, of all of your stakeholders. And that's the kind of general design I'm interested in.
So, you know, I don't think that the dichotomy is between dictatorship versus democracy. I've observed that, generally speaking, there needs to be a democracy amongst the people who are concretely contributing. And I think the thing that makes a difference in open source is that in the wider society, we've gone for global enfranchisement. Whereas in open source, you really should only be enfranchising the contributors, not also the consumers of the work of the community. Would you agree with that? Or do you think that we should also be enfranchising end users who contribute nothing?
I think there's something to be said in a highly expert community for things that approach or aspire towards meritocracy and have multiple levels of engagement. I think a direct democracy to me is always most notable for its very dramatic failures. I was always struck living in Switzerland. I lived in Zurich for a brief period. It's famous for its anti-mosque rules that result from referenda. California as well. Living in California, it's direct democracy. It can be subject to mob rule. I think it has its place, and I think more importantly, we should recognize that elected representatives or our elites aren't that great at it either. If politicians are making effective choices, it's because they have a staff. They're surrounded by a staff of experts. They have a library, the Library of Congress, for example. They have to do their research. They have to learn about a domain to make effective decisions in it. So it's really more about having the time and having the resources. If every citizen, or if the more passive contributors to your community had a cabinet of experts to access in the process of making decisions, and they had the motivation and the time to contribute those, then I would trust them as much as any more invested contributor. So it's less about how much you've given to the code base. It's more how much you're willing to give to the management of the project.
Right. And I think I'd agree with that. I think that contribution has many colors. And, I'm very happy to the idea of enfranchising the people who do the run public events for the community, or the people that create the documentation. My concern is more about enfranchising. This comes from, an experience of a community where it has a very large global community of end users. And a lot of people believe that that community of end users should have the deciding voice in what the open source project does. And I actually think that's wrong. I think that an open source
project, I'm not going to go as far as wrong.
Is a collaboration of co-contributors. And when you're not a contributor, you probably shouldn't be getting a vote.
I'll go slightly different, which is that every governance design decision has upsides and downsides. And direct democracy is going to have clear upsides and clear downsides. We know them, at least that it's a known quantity. And I could see it, the most utopian picture is going to be that warts and all, is going to be a starting place, a starting point to something worth value, which is a large community of people that you're providing these skills of self-governance to. Now, that's a little idealistic, and I wouldn't fault anybody for using a more closed circle, leaving at least key core community decisions to core contributors who have demonstrated their willingness to put the time into the project necessary to make good decisions. But I'm still hopeful for bad direct democracy as a pathway to a utopian good direct democracy. Which, that's where you get spillover effects into maintaining large-scale democracies like the countries we live in. democracy is a muscle you have to practice every day, and there's no better way of gaining the skills than daily participation. So providing opportunities for that is both naive and the upside of naive, which is hopeful. The one way I like to put it is there's no better way to develop a really fine-tuned radar for abuse of power than to have had the experience of being able to abuse power yourself in running the small things in daily life, whether that's the kitchen sink or the garden club or your OSS project.
Right. So, to round that thought out, my instinct as a community designer is to enfranchise those who are qualified and to not enfranchise those who are not qualified. Do you think that's a fair approach? Should I be enfranchising the uneducated and unqualified as well?
Well, first, I would. It's not your instinct. I think it's your experience. Your instinct sounds like maybe you started off as more of an advocate of direct democracy and you saw the downside, you experienced the downsides of it. I would be a little less binary. I think there are some types of decisions or some types of pathways that make a lot of sense for including everybody. And you see it, right? Bug trackers, issues on GitHub. Those are a pathway for everybody. Sometimes participation roadmaps and user surveys. These are all ways of integrating the needs, and they're less direct. Maybe they don't provide the freedom or opportunity to vote. So I tend to think in terms of little steps. There's really, really substantive decisions, and I would like to see those made by people who have a track record of contributing meaningfully to substantive decisions. And so I'm in favor of a more continuous version of what you're describing, personally.
Right. I have to say, I've got very bad experiences of voting in Bugzilla, where every end user in the world all votes for the impractical thing that they want implemented, but nobody can possibly afford to do. The one difference, of course, between open source communities and public communities is that if an open source community goes badly wrong, a group of people can simply fork. Whereas that's generally frowned on in civil society. I'm not allowed to comment on politics on this show, but I could imagine a situation where there might be people in a country who want to fork, and I believe that's called an insurrection. Does that difference really make a difference? The freedom to fork.
Absolutely. I think you can call it, voting with your feet isn't really a credible mechanism in a lot of places. Voting with your feet is sort of the basis of economic applications to like municipal governance. When we do economics on cities, there's sort of this basis of voting with your feet. That doesn't really make a lot of sense because you can't just up and leave. It's not that easy. You have to change your life. A move is one of the most stressful things that happens to people. But in an online community, the fact that you can vote with your feet with a click of a button, and you don't have just freedom to exit, but what you might call entrepreneurial exit, the freedom not just to leave for a competitor, but to leave for your own version of this system is really unique to the internet and adds a whole other dimension to design. Now, I think you can react to that by putting everything in exit as a solution to everything. I think that's a huge mistake. What I think it is important to do is recognize it as a tool in the toolkit and continue to use everything else. You really see this in DAOs. DAOs really went naively into direct democracy, and they see all the failures of that and more. The DAOs that I'm most impressed by are the ones that are using very old, centuries or millennia old toolkits. They do politics. they talk. They build community very intentionally out off the chain, outside of the software. Those are where you see high participation and more and less high levels of being informed voters.
Of course, the problem with DAOs is they embrace the worship of the perfection of code to the point where people discover that the bugs that have inevitably been written take all their money away. So I tended to view DAOs as unfortunately naive in there. They have a dyspeptic view of humanity, and they believe code is perfect. And I think they've probably got it wrong in both counts there.
I've been fortunate to meet a lot of people who run a lot of DAOs, and that's where they start. but you make enough, $30 million mistakes, and you start to lose your naivete really quick. And so one thing that makes me hopeful about DAOs that they are thousands of little laboratories for people to learn these lessons on their own. Hopefully, cheaply and sometimes very expensively.
Well, I need to jump in here, and there are a bunch of questions that are backed up on our back channel, including from other co-hosts, at least one other co-host who is eager to contribute. One of his questions already Simon asked, but we'll get to those in a moment. But first, I have to let everybody know that this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Collide. That's Collide with a K. Collide is a device trust solution that ensures unsecured devices can't access your apps. Collide has some big news. If you're an Okta user, Collide can get your entire fleet up to 100% compliance. Collide patches one of the major holes in zero trust architecture, device compliance. Think about it. Your identity provider only lets known devices log into apps, but just because a device is known doesn't mean it's in a secure state. In fact, plenty of the devices in your fleet probably shouldn't be trusted. Maybe they're running on out-of-date OS versions, or maybe they've got unencrypted credentials lying around. If a device isn't compliant or isn't running the Collide agent, it can't access the organization's SaaS apps or other resources. The device user can't log into your company's cloud apps until they fix the problem on their end. It's that simple. For example, a device will be blocked if an employee doesn't have an up-to-date browser. Using end-user remediation helps drive your fleet to 100% compliance without overpowering your IT team. Without Collide, IT teams have no way to solve these compliance issues or to stop insecure devices from logging in. With Collide, you can set and enforce compliance across your entire fleet, Mac, Windows, and Linux. Collide is unique in that it makes device compliance part of the authentication process. When a user logs on with Okta, Collide alerts them to compliance issues and prevents unsecured devices from logging in. It's a security you can feel good about because Collide puts transparency and respect for users at the center of their product. To sum it up, Collide's method means fewer support tickets, less frustration, and most importantly, 100% fleet compliance. Visit collide.com/floss to learn more or book a demo. That's KOLIDE.com/floss. I'm looking back up the thing here. There's a great one-liner. Direction of the code is very different from direction of the wiki, and the wiki is where the users often participate, and the code is not. Though maybe it's both. I don't know. So I think you've touched on that. But another question. Here's another one from.
I can touch a bit more.
Yeah, touch a bit more on that. Yeah, that's good.
Feature requests, feature voting are a great example. What do you vote for when you're voting on a feature? You're voting on what you want. And what you're doing as a core contributor when you're voting on a feature is you're voting on what the code needs, what the community needs. And so, users are, it's the popularity contest is what I want. And that's your framing. If you frame it as forget what you want, what is best for the community? Here's our roadmap. Here's our mission. Here's what we're trying to accomplish in the world as a code base. What's best for that? Does that magically solve everything? Do users suddenly stop being self-interested? No. Will you get more reflection and maybe if you even ask the question twice, what do you want? What's best for the code base? And this is what you get. So focusing on core contributors gives you that as a side focus, the people thinking of what's best for the project. you get it as a side effect. And there's other ways to get that. There's other ways to get people thinking about what's good for the project. So this comes down to informing people, setting things up, and making it clear what they're voting on when they're voting. You're participating in the project and the needs for the project. This isn't a user survey for us to find out what the users want. This is a decision-making mechanism for us to support this commons, support this public good, support this project collectively.
So I don't know how relevant this is, but I think it's important. You know, I was for 24 years an editor for Linux Journal, and every time I talked to Linus or anybody talked to Linus, he'd always say, when people brought up user issues, he'd say, that's user space, I'm kernel space. And there's this very sharp distinction in Linux kernel development between kernel space and user space. And kernel developers would tell me, we only care about what's good for the kernel and what the kernel is good for, and it's very, very broad. Yet we know that obviously the needs of large corporate customers, large corporate users, the entities that are one step that are between the kernel developers and the actual users of the kernel in whatever application it might be. And now with Linux, it's everything pretty much. But how that influence works and how you keep that influence, especially big corporate influence, from corrupting, as it were, the kernel itself. And you may not have a direct answer for that, but it's an interesting one because there are these layers that are involved between the creators of the code and the actual users of the code.
Yeah, it's nice to bring in corporate because it breaks these dichotomies, you know, core contributors versus user, and it really gets you in this picture of types or styles. There's very different types or styles of stakeholder. They all have really different needs and wants and resources. And, you know, an ideal design has made all the mistakes. And then taking into account those potential mistakes gives, you know, corporate stakeholders this extra power, but denies them that extra power, and gives users this extra power, but denies them that extra power, and gives core contributors maybe a bigger slice of the pie, but places checks on them. You know, this is your hindsight is 2020 kind of governance design, where you really have a clear sense of every potential, you know, plate at the table, and what they're going to try to get away with, and you can design for that. Linux, I'm involved in a large comparative study of several open source foundations. There's about over 100 in the world. And you can really see in the variety in their designs how they've each come to the problem of inordinate corporate influence. You see a very different approach at Linux Foundation, which is a little bit pay to play, versus Apache Software Foundation, which has very strict rules about how corporate actors, corporate sponsors, and the volunteers that they pay to contribute, what kind of role they can play in a project. And, you know, even in Apache, you see inordinate corporate influence, but it's tempered, I think, in intelligent ways, in ways that reflect a lot of foresight, in ways that reflect a lot of care for the fundamental values.
Right. Now, I've looked quite a lot at both of those. One thing I think I have to point out for listeners is that Linux Foundation and Apache Foundation are very different organizationally, because the Linux Foundation is a trade association that's acting in the interests of the members who are paying to support it, whereas the Apache Software Foundation is a public charity that is there to serve the general public and consequently is not swayed by the money of any contributors. And as I look across open source foundations, I generally see there are many more public charities than there are trade associations, but there is a lot more publicity for the trade association. So a lot more people have heard of Linux Foundation than have heard, for example, of the Python Software Foundation or the Document Foundation. And so I do think it's very important to make that distinction between, just because they use the word foundation at the end of their name, it doesn't mean that they're a charity in any way. They might well just be another Delaware corporation. Like, for example, the Rocky Linux Foundation is just a B Corp. It's not actually a charity of any kind. So I think it's very important to make that distinction and not let people hide behind that word foundation. Do you think that we should emphasize that more as we're talking about governance, so that people are able to understand that the governance that's serving the stakeholders varies between trade associations and public charities?
Well, you're talking to a person interested in institutional diversity, so of course, you know, the world should know. I think I am on some level comfortable treating them as apples to apples in terms of what support are they providing to their specific open source projects that are, you know, under their umbrella. And if they're, you know, if they're both, you know, more or less devoted to providing resources and supporting that code and making it healthy in the long term, then I'm comfortable treating them on the same level at the same time. Totally different organizational forms, totally different governance structure, totally different stakeholders and balance among those stakeholders. And so I like that we have a large ecosystem, again, hundreds of umbrella organizations that call them foundations or not, that support open large numbers of open source projects and help them solve that collective action problem. And I like that open source project developers have a lot of choice in which way they go. I think it's okay that, corporate needs are specific, and it's okay for a large number of companies to work together to develop open source code. Now, it's a little unfortunate, perhaps, that the venue they found to do that involved capture to some extent of Linux and its development. There's other places to go if you want to be involved in development and want an umbrella organization that acts consistently with your values.
So now you've studied Apache, that's Apache is a fascinating software foundation. It was in many ways the first fiduciary host for open source projects, and we can see a lot of the effects of maturity in there. I posit that the bigger the number of rules is, the more games there are that are playable on a foundation. Do you think that's true? Mm-hmm. Or do you think that organizations, as they solve their problems, gradually reach a position of stability in their governance?
That is a fundamental question of political science that is thousands of years old, hard to answer empirically. And a really fun thing for me about studying open source projects is I don't just serve open source software, I serve political theory. There's a chance. You don't have 100 Earths, and you need 100 Earths to answer the basic questions of governance. But you do have 100 or 1,000 or tens of thousands of open source projects. Subreddit discussion forums are an amazing place to study governance design at small scale. One of my favorite cases, and actually, honestly, one of the cases I'm most proud of, is a large comparative study of self-hosted Minecraft servers. Kids designing governance systems essentially a la carte, in line with their own folk theory of collective action, to solve the very important common pool resource and public good problems involved in running a game server and playing with your friends.
Right. So I've posited that any stable system of rules creates a gaming space proportional to the number of rules and the length of time they've been in operation. Do you think that it is viable to have subjective rules in an organization so that you can defer to your leadership and let them use the I know it when I see it approach? Or do you think it's better for open source communities in particular that tend to have a lot of very detail-focused individuals in them? Do you think it's better to have concrete rules that people can objectively and mechanically apply?
You're going to tend to be really disappointed at my willingness to take a strong stand on how things should be. There's clear failure modes. So there's clear potential failure modes to giving your leadership a lot of discretion. And there's clear benefits to that. And same for community management. So what I think is important is just be aware of what's going to go wrong, what's going to go right when you err in this versus that direction. What's most exciting to me for open source and for a lot of online communities is less tell them how to run and more design software, design tools that let communities continually experiment with their own governance. Benevolent dictatorship for a week. Let's try corporate overlord for a week. Let's try total anarchist duocratic governance for a week's ridiculous, for several months, for this year, for this next roadmap, for this next product release. Encouraging a culture of learning helps communities learn those downsides and navigate and iterate so that you don't, so that the price of learning your really important lesson about the value of user input doesn't come at the cost of being entrenched in a system that you stop respecting because it's learned that failure so dramatically. So encouraging change and dynamism and providing tools that make it possible for entire communities to go at this meta level, play with how they run, I think is really the way forward. Now, but again, you're getting my values. I care about open source. I think open source is really important for the world. It's not my leverage point, honestly. It's not where I'm investing myself to change the world. I love serving it and I love working with people who are driven by values. My leverage point is providing experiential education in self-governance to lots and lots of people. Open source is amazing for that, and a lot of other online communities are as well. And so by encouraging experimentation, we not only provide a probably rocky pathway towards better governance systems that are fit to each project, we also provide the education in sharing that's useful in every aspect of our lives and that transfers beyond the specific project we cut our teeth on.
So the reason that I keep on trying to get
hard answers
is because I've actually got a design. So I'm involved in designing the governance for a community at the moment. And I'm not going to have the luxury of putting in place a system where we can change the governance every 2 months based on our experience of what didn't work. And so I really do need to be able to look at a community and make some, concrete determinations. And so, the community that I'm helping design here, I've given them some concrete guidance. I've expressed my skepticism about direct democracy. I have expressed my skepticism about pay to play. And we've put in place some public charity governance. But my experiences with Apache show that there are plenty of ways that a determined individual can take all of the good intent that we've put into our governance and use it against us. And I'm really looking to work out, what can I do about that? What can I do about that in advance?
And you're absolutely right. The way you're designing a governance system depends a lot on if you can assume good faith, interest in the common cause or not. And so the more open your boundaries are, the less you can assume that that everyone is acting in good faith, and the more valid it becomes to assume that out of your thousands of contributors, there's going to be a handful who are highly motivated to pursue their own interests and game the system toward their own ends. And the more you can close the boundaries or create boundaries that filter very intentionally, maybe very slowly, for people who have evidence of caring about the needs of the community and putting the needs of the community above their own needs, then you can design an increasingly utopian or assume good faith type of governance system. The answer is both, design. This is acknowledging the existence of different stakeholders with different levels of commitment. So for the random person coming off the street, I really would give some levers because that creates a path for them to demonstrate that good faith that build that gets them into maybe the core contributor group. Open source softwares, they tend to confound the core contributors with the people who are most likely to have the project interest in mind. And those, are probably like mostly overlapping, but not completely overlapping in a Venn diagram. So however you want to represent or filter for those people, some pathway where you can create a smaller set of rules for this proven set of people where you can assume good faith and you can provide a lot of power, authority, and freedom because you are able to assume that these people are going to put their interests first. There's no way of enforcing putting community interests first. And I think it is valuable. I think you're onto something in protecting against that. But I think you can also be a little bit less absolutist. Yes, you've been burned. Yes, you've seen things go really bad. There's ways to protect against that without cutting users out.
Right. So another question that comes out of all this, you know, one of your threats is your own people and people for whom assume good faith doesn't apply. The other category that I've seen happening in other organizational styles is where you employ a staff and gradually you get Purnell's law cutting in and the organization begins to transform into one that's run for the benefit of its staff rather than for its community. Do you have any hints for how to prevent that from happening?
There's lots of kinds of stakeholders. I've definitely seen it. It is a threat. I haven't studied it specifically. I tend to study volunteer-run communities. It's analogous to the way that you protect against capture of any entrenched interest. But really the most fundamental thing you can do is hire onto staff people who care about community, because there is going to be some level in the most successful systems, there's going to be some level of norm-driven rather than rule-driven protection of community values. To some extent, your really powerful people just have to internalize the importance of hearing lots of stakeholders and remembering who they serve.
So at the risk of spooking you and cursing a community, are there any communities that you look to that have got their governance pretty much perfect?
No one doesn't complain about their governance. I think governance is just something you complain about. And it illustrates the point, right? That there's no right system, that you're always making decisions that are going to have upsides and downsides. And people just tend to be more in touch with the downsides because that's the cause of the problems they have to spend, too much time dealing with. But when I really admire a system, it's because they've, there's no shortcuts, but one, shortcut, hire a community manager, have someone who's doing project management for, creating a population that's, ready for, that's up for democracy, and that's trained for democracy, that's trained for participation. I'm less interested in how do we create the governance system that's right for this population, and I'm kind of interested in how do we create the population that's right for this governance system, making ourselves worthy of the systems that we're serving. And community managers do that. They create a pathway for finding people, for building excitement and enthusiasm, and creating a pathway for the most enthusiastic and excited and reliable people to gain leadership, to get responsibility in a system. Rules are great. Rules are important. The most exciting action, where the action is for me, is in culture building, instilling norms, values. And so some of my most exciting conversations are with culture builders, community managers, because that's the work. That's the work in making democracy not a flaming pile of crap. I don't know. There's good problems and bad problems. And so, yes, everyone's complaining about their governance. But when they're complaining about no one being involved, that's a problem that doesn't impress me. When they're complaining about the users who are kind of too passionate and taking up too much space at meetings, if there's more than one of them, then I'm impressed. Then I'm like, wow, you're doing community right. So that's a little bit of an answer to your question.
So you just said something that really struck me about it seemed to be a distinction between democracy and contribution being different things. Obviously, democracy can involve contribution, but contribution is a different thing. And I think people mean contribution sometimes when they're talking about democracy, a sense that one has value, that one can contribute to something, even if one's level of contribution or one's vote doesn't count for more than a unit of one, where others may be 10 or 100 or something like that. I'm wondering if you could explore that a little more, partly just to get people's definitions right, because I think people tend to think of democracy as way approaches to voting, you know, direct representative, you know, representative in the sense that the U.S. has, you know, like the Electoral College, for example, a very indirect form of democracy. Yeah. And I think one that's deeply flawed, and I don't think we're being political in saying that.
Voting in my view is neither necessary nor sufficient for democracy. I think you've got that right. There's kind of two things in there. Well, you know, so I don't know which direction you're asking me to riff. One is
any you like.
Okay. Great. To your first point, separating kind of contributor from governance, this is another reason why it's so important to evade utopian questions. Is the governance system you end up with is dependent on the system and the context you started in. And you see it really clearly in open source projects. This conflating, which I think is a productive conflation of code contributors and sort of political power. So Python made a very intentional choice that core code contributors have a lot of political power. And I think that's smart. I think it's good design. I think it probably has downsides. For example, maybe it undervalues other types of contribution of the project. Maybe it asks, you know, political skills are different than code skills. So you kind of, you know, can get yourself in trouble. But overall, it just makes a lot of sense because those are the people who have demonstrated care at the global level for the global project. So great. Take advantage of that upside and then design for the downsides by providing how to run a meeting training for your code contributors by having extra projects or pathways for other kinds of contributors to give. And so this is that path dependence in play. Well, we found great people. They don't have the right skills and they're not everybody who matters, but they make a lot of sense as a first stab for our governance system. So this kind of path dependent or evolutionary view of governance growth, really kind of drives it home that it's not about imposing or you know, copy pasting one perfect governance system on every project. It's more about providing tools, capabilities for change and evolution over time, you know, as a function of your own project specific history. So that's riffing off of the first kind of theme you offered. And then on the second, I can probably stop at how I started, which is voting is neither necessary nor sufficient.
I know Simon has one in the waiting, but I had to look. I thought, I'm going to go back and look at the Linux kernel mailing list to see if Linus is still in charge. And the only thing I see there is whatever he says to somebody, shut the F up. So...
I was very pleased to see last night Linus testing a new Mastodon account. There's social.kernel.org opened yesterday, so we're going to see a whole new avenue. Yes.
That's interesting.
At Linus at social.kernel.org. That account went live yesterday. What's going to happen there, do you think, Seth? Because, you know, Mastodon is attempting to be a distributed emergent governance system. Is that going to work, or are we going to be overrun by people who want to put up walls against every other server in the end?
Both, right? I mean, yeah, you don't have to ask me. It's going to introduce more fragmentation in the media space, which is going to be, which means the communities that do develop are going to be more unique and be really good at specifically serving the people they serve. It's going to be hard to find those if you're an outsider trying to find your way, and you're going to struggle a bit. You know, yes, there's this federation component. Yes, they're linked to each other. That's going to provide some tempering of this fragmentation kind of tendency. There's a clear upside to Twitter, right? That it's the one place everyone's on, and there's clear downside to Twitter, and the same with Mastodon. Sorry to be so evasive. But
yeah. No, I see a very clear downside to Twitter at the moment, which is why I've stopped using it.
That's right. That's a little bit of a mental hygiene. I'm experiencing the downside of the system, I just try to remember there's upsides to this. You know, shut the F up. You know, very clear downsides to a strongly centralized unitary governance. And the upsides are crystal clear. You know, it doesn't struggle with roadmap. It doesn't struggle with direction. And it's become very successful. And so I'm willing to, you know, nod at that. And it's a really important hygiene for me to always remember, when I'm really facing only the upsides of a system. In the case of Mastodon, its ability to filter effectively, and build communities of practice, what downsides are going to come with that. We have to get ahead of that. Otherwise we're just going to be that pendulum swinging from one platform to another.
Yeah. So, the good thing about Mastodon is that when I do decide that I'm tired of wherever I'm hanging out there, I can actually move and take my social graph with me, which is a thing I simply can't do on Facebook or Twitter. So, I have the freedom to fork as a non-coder on Mastodon. Okay. But the question really to ask about Mastodon is, when the governance that's going to emerge there is going to be one that's very much the expression of Lawrence Lessig's code is law approach to governance. We're going to see what's encoded into the system set the rules much more than the norms of the individuals who are using the system. Do you agree with that, or do you think that we're going to see the users find a way to take control?
Well, I mean, to whatever extent that's true on Mastodon, it's more true on Twitter. So Mastodon is going to be a step in the right direction towards a norm or social-based order, which actually has huge downsides. It can be super oppressive and difficult, but I'm generally a fan of moving that direction. So if there's hope of getting out of code is law into something more dynamic, where code is some of the law and norms are some of the law, I think Mastodon's really a step in the right direction, and I'm definitely watching closely. And if I have anything, lack of hope for it, and I'm overall hopeful for it, it's less on its design. I think the design's wonderful and very inspiring, and it's great to have an open source foundation for social media. I'm just a little, I just don't know if it's going to capture those network effects. If our best hope for Mastodon isn't something Mastodon does, but Elon Musk continuing to mess up, I wouldn't call that a strategy for growth. But on the governance, I'm very excited. I'm very excited to provide governance tools to Mastodon instances and let them turn into laboratories for governance for themselves.
Are you hanging out on Mastodon somewhere? Can I follow you there?
You can see below my name, it still says at Twitter, right?
Yeah. It does look kind of Twitterish. What's down there?
Yeah, it does look kind of Twitterish.
Yeah. I'm overdue.
I am in two places on Mastodon, and I admit to still using Twitter more. But I could see some kind of moving over. But I'm thinking too, Seth. We don't have much time left, but I want to get your thoughts on media fragmentation itself. I think part of what's going on is that the internet's eaten everything. It is now, we are living digital lives now that are far more interesting and complex than what they were 20, 30 years ago, or even 10 years ago. And I was thinking, for example, in music, it used to be able to only produce music through relatively few record companies and consume it only through physical media. And now you can produce it anywhere. I mean, again, you get a little dependent on a YouTube or on a Spotify, but you have an awful lot of, there's enormous optionality in both production and consumption of music, to the degree that, there's a less of a common anyway, sense of what music, what's popular music now. It's very, very fragmented. So, but there are communities within those fragmentations, and they do cross-pollinate to some degree. I mean, I was with a bunch of relatively older people at a country show, a country music show recently, because I'm in a small town. you go to whatever's on, and there's opera this weekend, and then there's some country music, and there's, you can go to the country bar down the street, and it seems to be a relatively safe and fun place. So there is some cross-pollination. So I'm wondering, and I don't know if this goes to your specialties or not, but I'm sure you're paying attention to it.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a design decision, right? There's a quip I lean pretty hard on that I heard ages ago, which is, it's about Photoshop. Photoshop made good design better and bad design worse. And I see this really as the general effect of technology when people are asking, what's this change going to do? That, you know, you can get pretty far by leaning on that. Fragmentation as well. Fragmentation is going to make strong communities a lot stronger, more effective, and more influential and beneficial to their participants. And it's going to make bad communities worse, which is not just like null, but it, you know, hurt people. And I think that's what we can look forward to as media fragmentation increases, whether that is distributed social media or the democratization of a lot of traditional gatekeeping tools, music, books, radio, podcasts, so on.
Yeah, I'm developing a community myself, sort of. I hate to say it's on Facebook, but it's in a group on Facebook where I never see any ads. But it's entirely devoted to shooting pictures of radio transmitters that will be off the air in 5 years. Because radio is a dead medium walking right now. You know, a senator in the U.S. is trying to save AM radio. And AM radio, there's nobody investing in it. There's nobody, the radios all suck at playing it, and the few that still have it. And but I sort of see communities growing around everything. That one is a purely accidental one that just has to do with an old obsession of mine. I like to look at towers and antennas, and I'm an old AM radio guy, and I kind of like those things. And antennas are invisible now because they're working on frequencies that are so high that an antenna can fit in your hand, yeah, you know, or inside a clock, and nobody knows it's there. And I'm not sure I'm going with this, except that it seems to me that humans are social creatures. I mean, you study this, right? We're going to develop groups, and we're going to govern them, and civilization is doing that without violence, I think. Would that be a summary statement of some kind? I'm not sure if it is or not.
if we're wrapping it up, providing opportunities for communities to be intentional about how they're structured, and to either, you know, change or bail ship when they've learned their lesson, whatever hundreds of lessons that is, I think is really inspiring direction to go. And I've been really honored, lucky to be able to push it.
Well, that's great. And I think we're about out of time at this point. So we always close with like three questions. One is, the first is, the second is too brief to even mention right now, but the first is there anything we haven't talked about you'd like us to have brought up?
Oh, dozens of things. I could keep going all day.
I know. I wanted to ask on MetaGov. So maybe just a quick one on what MetaGov does.
Great. MetaGov, the Meta Governance Project, metagov.org, is a research organization that I'm active in, bringing together developers, e-democracy advocates, lawyers, media scholars, data scientists, theoretical computer scientists. It's really a beautifully vibrant community that I'm very passionate about, that is interested in using online communities as laboratories for governance design and experimentation. And so that's really the hub of our activity around providing tools that any community can bring in to experiment actively in how they run. Other organizations that I'm passionate or excited about while we're plugging. This seems like the best for that community so far.
Yeah, and that's at metagov.org. And there are lots of things listed there, a long outline. So I advise people to take a look at that to know more about one of the many things Seth's involved in. So Seth, to close, what are your favorite text editor and scripting language?
I'm in Vim, and I work actively between Python and R. It's like fun. It's fun to build figures. It's fun to do stats now. It's fun to do data munging in. So I'll start off in Python for kind of raw Mungy glue everything together, maybe with a bridge to SQL, because that's also a lot of fun when you're above 10 million data points, but wrapping up in R, which I just have a lot of fun in, and all in, yeah, Vim.
That is a longer answer than I expected. I love it. So I think our listeners and viewers will too. So Seth, thanks so much for being on the show. This has been a great hour, and we have a lot left over, and we'll have to have you back in a bit to see where things have gone.
Wonderful.
After some interval. Thanks for having me. And so Simon, you learn a lot in this hour?
Yes, I think so. And I've also revisited a whole load of things that I haven't read for a long time. Because it turns out, you know, I don't know the degree to which you knew, Doc, but I've written about a whole load of these things previously.
Between
7 and 9 years ago. And so there's lots of flashbacks coming back from evaluating some of my greatest failures in community design. I could mention some of them because they've ceased to exist. others live on, and so I probably shouldn't mention them. So all fascinating stuff. All I wish is that Seth could give me the answers rather than just tell me what the questions were.
Yeah, well, you know, it's all a project. I mean, that's what strikes me about every open source code base. If it's alive, it's a project, and it's not done. I mean, when I talked to Andrew Morton, who we haven't had on the show, maybe he's been on the show before I came along a few years ago, but he said, you know, his whole work is stamping out bugs. That's it. You know, he's a Linux kernel guy. I don't know if he's as active as he used to be, but he used to be a real alpha dude in the Linux community. And, you know, and he said it would still be a project 200 years from now. He said it's most likely likely code base to be going in 200 years than anything else he knew. So I think these things never end. So what do you want to plug this week?
I have very few holes that need plugging at the moment, Doc. I'm still spending all of my time dealing with the European Union's Cyber Resilience Act and its consequences. And the main thing I'd like to ask is if there's anyone who is a member of a community open source project in Europe who would like to provide me with a case study of the impact of the CRA on their community, then please get in touch. All the details are on the website or on the screen. But that's really the only thing I have to plug.
Well, that's great. I need to plug next week when we have Levi Maya on. Levi is another friend, guy I know personally. He lives in Santa Barbara, where we are plugging everything right now. We're getting huge rains there, which is unusual. We have friends staying in our house, too, which needs plugging. Turns out they went there for the sunny Southern California thing, and it's not there. I think where Seth is, it's even rainier. Anyway, but he's coming up next week, and I believe Sean Powers is going to be joining us for that. So come back for that. It's going to be really interesting because he's a pilot and he's a hacker and he's involved in a filmmaker. He's involved in a lot of stuff. So that's coming up next week. And I will see you all then.
Listeners of this program get an ad-free version if they're members of Club Twit. $7 a month gives you ad-free versions of all of our shows. Plus, membership in the Club Twit Discord, a great clubhouse for Twit listeners. And finally, the Twit Plus feed with shows like Stacy's Book Club, The Untitled Linux Show, The Giz Fizz, and more. Go to twit.tv/clubtwit. And thanks for your support.